the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. The United States Supreme Court handed down its long-expected decisions on the issues of the Ten Commandments, in particular cases from Kentucky and Texas, challenges to the public presentation of the Ten Commandments. It was a split decision. The Ten Commandments are out in Kentucky, but they can stay in Texas. In the second segment, we're going to revisit this question. I'm going to tell you what is behind this decision, the logic, both in the majority opinions and in the dissents. And we're going to talk about what this means. I think it's going to be an interesting conversation about what this means for America and how we as Christians should think this through. What does the public publication or presentation of the Ten Commandments mean? What does it mean that that is declared to be unconstitutional in certain settings? What does it mean for us in terms of our Christian witness and Christian responsibility? First, a review of issues in the news. Yesterday marked the 35th anniversary of gay pride celebrations in America. The public observance of a gay pride day goes all the way back now to 1970, where you had the first big public demonstrations, and they are, well, let's just say colorful. City by city, the kinds of displays and the floats and the parade and the costumes may vary, but it has become a carnival, in many ways, of the homosexual movement. What's interesting is how this has been transformed over the years from something of a counterculture protest to something of a mainstream culture celebration. Because, well, just take the story that is in today's New York Times and the New York Report. The story is entitled A Day of Pride and Feathers on the March. No, I'm not making this up. And in it, it says this. Listen. We've got rainbow flags on police vehicles. Can you believe this? One of the parade's announcers shouted into a microphone at 24th Street. How many years has that taken? So in other words, we have the Metropolitan Police in New York City that are putting gay pride emblems on their cars. That's what the rainbow represents, a supposed symbol of diversity. And you have the revelers in the gay pride celebration on Gay Pride Day in New York City on yesterday, celebrating that now the police are no longer making the arrests. The police are protecting those who are doing the reveling, the celebrating on Gay Pride Day, and are actually putting these emblems on their cars. Now, how many years has that taken? That was the question asked by this particular homosexual marcher in yesterday's New York parade. Well, we can date that precisely. It has taken 35 years. You know, the more I think about this, I think that 3.5 decades really does represent a massive period of social change in America. I think if you go back to 1970, you fast forward to 2005, if you were to have been asleep and out of the country for the last 35 years and you were to come back, my guess is the biggest moral and cultural change you would note would be the open acceptance of homosexuality. I think it would be hard to argue with that, but with some other thesis about what would be most remarkable. I think that is probably the biggest change in America's moral and cultural landscape. 35 years of gay pride marked yesterday. Many times on this program, we have been revisiting the issue of marriage and especially its meaning. We as Christians have an entirely different understanding than the secular world does about why marriage is important. And we understand that it's not merely a lifestyle option, but rather it is the basic molecular unit of civilization, and beyond that, it is the context in which God's glory is displayed in the right ordering of his creation, a man and a woman coming together within the sacred covenant of marriage. We understand that into marriage, God pours all these gifts and all these responsibilities, and we understand that marriage is in many ways the crucible of adult making. It is the hallmark of adulthood, and a culture that no longer aspires to marriage produces a generation of, well, extended adolescence. How many times have we discussed this on the program? Now in London, The Times, that is the major and most illustrious newspaper in the British world, is publishing an article in the June 26 edition entitled Men Behave Singularly Like Eternal Bachelors. The lead sentence is this: Britain is turning into a bachelor nation. A study reveals that the country has a greater proportion of unattached men than at any time since the 1940s. Half of today's 25-year-old men have never married. Not only, by the way, does the article say they've never married, it says they've never even cohabitated. The number of 30-year-old males similarly unattached has doubled over the same period. The London School of Economics reports that while both men and women are delaying marriage and serious relationships, the effect is much more pronounced among men. Let me put a little footnote in right here. That's what we've been talking about. This extended adolescence among males is a phenomenon of a culture that has lost its moral sensibilities, that has lost marriage as the cultural aspiration and the mark of adult accountability. Now, also in this article, there's a very fascinating report that these young men are just living with their parents. They're refusing to grow up. And here's the interesting thing, and we should not be surprised by this. Not only are they failing to develop what this article would call enduring romantic relationships, they're also failing to mature in terms of economics, in terms of civic responsibility, in terms of professional maturity, and all the rest. And we should be the people who understand that all goes together. We will revisit this question again, but it is fascinating to see the secular media begin to latch onto this as a very serious issue. Extended adolescence, especially among young men, not a good sign for the culture. The Boston Globe is reporting that scientists are developing a new blood test that is even now being marketed to American women and offers them the chance to find out whether they are carrying a boy or a girl almost at the very time they discover that they are pregnant. This particular report comes along, this test, suggesting that women who have been pregnant only as long as 5 weeks can now take this test. It is a simple blood test. They mail the test overnight to Lowell, Massachusetts, where a laboratory does the processing. And a pregnant woman can know very quickly, within hours and days, as the article says, what color to paint the nursery. Now notice this article in the very third paragraph says this, or even to decide whether to get an abortion if she wants a child of the opposite sex. Now here's another issue that we have talked about again and again. This whole process of sex selection and how that ties into the biomedical crisis and how especially it relates to the question of abortion. Let's just face the facts. Abortion is now so readily available in America that we have become the place known around the world for sex selection technologies and sex selection abortions. This test enables a woman to know almost at the very same time she discovers that she is pregnant, whether she is carrying a boy or a girl baby, and thus to make the decision that matches her aspiration. Bioethicist Arthur Kaplan of the University of Pennsylvania says, and I quote, you can tiptoe around it, but the fact is that if you're sending information about sex, then you're in the sex selection testing business. He said that he would not ban the test, but he said, quote, I would condemn it, end quote. Folks, just in recent months, we've been looking at news stories out of China and out of India indicating a vast number of young men who will never have mates, never have wives, because the sex selection process, often enforced with something like China's one-child policy, has meant an imbalance between the genders that has left millions and millions of young men without any prospect of marriage. That is not healthy, to say the very least. The insidious assault upon the fetus, the unborn human baby, continues, and now there is an additional cause, an earlier test that will just lead to the further expansion of abortion, and for reasons no more fundamental than choosing the baby of the preferred sex. The Anglican Communion is being split apart by the issue of homosexuality. That's not news, but the news is that the Anglican Consultative Council has now formally asked the American and Canadian Anglican churches, in the U.S. it's called the Episcopal Church USA, to withdraw. The American and Canadian churches have been flouting and flaunting their violation of Episcopal and Canadian and Anglican doctrine and church law by, in the American case, electing and consecrating an openly gay man as the Bishop of New Hampshire, and in both American and Canadian units of the church, developing rights for the blessing of same-sex unions. This is leading to what will inevitably be a schism within the Anglican Communion. Reports now out of Africa indicate that churches there, in particular the Anglican Communions in Kenya, Nigeria, and Uganda, are now talking about withdrawing from the Anglican Communion and forming their own union. They are already rejecting money from the Episcopal Church USA, so there can be no claims or ties of economic dependency. An issue of truth, as fundamental as this, threatens to split the Anglican Communion, but if the church is going to be the people of truth, we have no choice but to stand upon the authority of the Word of God. Folks, on Friday, I discussed Joel Osteen, the pastor of the Lakewood Church in Houston, Texas, and you'll remember that I criticized him for having, on the Larry King program, basically said the unforgivable. But, of course, it's not unforgivable. He was very unclear about the gospel. He wandered all over the place. He seemed even to insinuate that atheists might be in heaven. But on his web post over the weekend, on his own website, he's issued an apology, and I want to give him credit because it is a very clear apology. In the first place, he says very clearly that he does believe that it is only through Christ that we have hope in eternal life. He went on to say, "I regret and sincerely apologize that I was unclear on the very thing to which I've dedicated my life." That's good news. I want to give him credit. In a day in which many apologies are pseudo-apologies, Joel Osteen did not say the statements were made. He said, "I made a mistake," and he set the record straight. We might have other issues to discuss with Mr. Osteen, but hats off for an honest apology and for a restatement of Christian truth. We'll be right back to talk about the impact of the Ten Commandments decision. Live from Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. It is always interesting to get to the end of the term for the U.S. Supreme Court because it's like the final gate opens and out come some of the most controversial decisions of the term. And no surprise this year, we all knew that the decisions on the Ten Commandments cases were coming after all the oral arguments were held way back in the fall. And the basic issues are out there in front of us for everyone to see. In McCreary County, Kentucky, the issue was a display of the Ten Commandments with other documents from American history inside the courthouse. You can imagine it was the ACLU and others who said that's unconstitutional. It's a government establishment of religion. It has to be taken out. In Texas, the issue was a Ten Commandments monument that had been there for 40 years outside of the courthouse. And it had not been a source of controversy until recently. But, of course, with the litigious society we now face and with people like Americans United and People for the American Way and the American Civil Liberties Union out there trolling for cases, they found this one and made it an issue. Two cases, two different sets of oral arguments, one court, nine justices. The bottom line, 2-5-4 decisions. Some little swinging between here and there, and the particular swing is between the yes and the no. To the Kentucky Ten Commandments displays, no. The majority opinion declared that the particular display here in Kentucky violates the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. It's out. But by a 5-4 majority, the same court on the same day released a statement saying that the Texas display is just fine, at least for now. The argument behind all of this is convoluted, and you can imagine that there's a whole lot of dissection going on as legal scholars and others are taking a close look at these decisions. I have read the opinions and the dissents, and let me tell you, there's some fascinating stuff. But in order to help us get through all of this, we have an expert on the line. Jeff Schaefer is senior counsel for the Alliance Defense Fund, an organization that does great work in terms of protecting religious liberty. Mr. Schaefer, welcome to the Albert Mohler Program.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let me tell you, I'm trying to make sense out of this. And, Jeff, we need you. What in the world do these two cases taken together mean?
Well, I think you're in the position that most folks with common sense find themselves in. Anytime you pick up a Supreme Court opinion, you're facing the possibility that you're going to not understand what's being communicated, because that's often the case. The court certainly is expert in arbitrariness, and these decisions are certainly no exception to that. This is a hodgepodge, as you'd indicated, a divided court. We had a plurality opinion in the Texas case, which means that only not a full majority went either way. We got, of course, Justice Breyer to join the good guys, so we actually won the case, but the arguments being used in support of that decision were even divided. Of course, in the Kentucky case, likewise, there was another 5-4 decision with a number of opinions being written in both directions, everyone disagreeing with each other, so it really is a mess.
Well, it was Justice Kennedy that wrote the majority opinion in the Kentucky case, and why are we not surprised, I guess we can say, following Justice
actually,
Kennedy.
Actually, Justice Souter.
Justice Souter. Well, in this particular thing, it is Justice Souter here. Excuse me. He says, "We hold that the counties," that's in Kentucky, "manifest objective may be dispositive of the constitutional inquiry and that the development of the presentation should be considered when determining its purpose."
Yeah, that's really a remarkable statement. So the display itself is really not what's being looked at by Justice Souter and the majority in the opinion. They're trying to look into the minds of those who got the display put up on the walls anyway. So
okay,
the same
display
in two different places could result in a different conclusion because of what was in the minds of those who put it up.
Well, somehow I think that just to show they went to law school, they have to use the word dispositive. I mean, you'll notice they find a way to work that into almost every one of these opinions. But let me give you my disposition on this, and that is that it's nonsense because it basically is a form of psychotherapy, basically.
That's right.
And what Justice Souter, writing for the majority here, seems to be saying is that, look, these people had a religious motivation when they put this up.
Yes. And the thing, and that is enough to send him into orbit. That's just completely intolerable that any government official would act in a way motivated by a religious motivation. We have to keep in mind what we're talking about here are documents hanging on a wall. Now, let's keep in mind the text of the First Amendment, which prescribes an establishment of religion. It says, Congress shall pass no law respecting an establishment of religion. Fast forward to today, and we've distorted that to the point where documents on a wall, they aren't doing anything, they're not imposing on anyone, they're just hanging there. Text in a frame is now being determined to be a violation of the Constitution, and not necessarily because of what it is, but because of what motivated the people who hung the Ten Commandments on the wall.
And Mr. Schaefer, also they're saying whether or not there was any controversy when the monument or the display was put up. I mean, I'm looking here at Justice Breyer's written opinion. He says, for instance, in the Texas case, a difficult and borderline case, he says that what he finds determinative is that 40 years passed in which the presence of this monument, legally speaking, went unchallenged.
We might ask why on earth that has anything to do with whether it's a constitutional monument or not.
Well, you know, Mr. Schaefer, it seems to me that if he's really going to follow that line of argument, then school prayer ought to be legal because it went for, what, a century before anyone made any complaint.
Well, these justices are very selective in how they apply these principles. That certainly works in this particular case, but he would be loath to use that same principle in the school prayer cases, undoubtedly.
Now, the other interesting thing here seems to be geography. And Mr. Schaefer, what they seem to be saying is, look, you can't have the display in the courthouse where people have to pass it in order to get into the courtroom, but you can have it out in the yard where people could just as easily pass a tree or a light post, I presume, and thus they don't have to be contaminated by coming into contact with the Ten Commandments.
An altogether arbitrary distinction. The court seems to take advantage of the fact that it can make pronouncements and not have anyone respond to them. I call that their institutional privilege of arbitrariness. And it's certainly seen in these instances.
Well, Mr. Schaefer, you really helped us because, frankly, you begin to look at this and you wonder if you're the only person who's not getting it. You know, I feel myself obligated to respect the English language, and I don't mean to make light of this, but it really does frustrate me that a sane person, I think just a normal American trying to read these opinions, comes up with no coherent legal theory that's really at stake here.
Right.
And my thesis is that the big winner in these two decisions is the legal profession, because I think lawyers are going to have a field day. When the court says that every single display is going to have to be submitted to some kind of strict scrutiny test, it's going to be the lawyers and the judges who are going to be making those decisions, right?
Yes. These cases resolved absolutely nothing. What they did is created all kinds of new litigation. Trying to work through the implications of these decisions is going to take years, years and years. Now, we're hopefully going to see a change in personnel on the court that may assist in our efforts in this area, but that notwithstanding, that we've certainly been handed the ingredients for a fine mess here.
Mr. Schaefer, the Alliance Defense Fund, you and your colleagues do some really, really good work, and we're always glad to have you guys as guests because you get right to the legal issue here, but you also operate out of a worldview that understands there are even larger issues at stake. When it comes to the posting of the Ten Commandments and all the rest, you know, why do you consider this important to us anyway? It's just the public posting of the Ten Commandments. It's not like they said the Ten Commandments are illegal. Should we really be concerned about this?
Absolutely. This really involves the foundations for the morality that informs our government. To the extent that the court indicates the Constitution says our religious beliefs cannot inform even a public statement, that's moving toward the direction that it can't inform our policies either, and that's a very dangerous precedent.
And I think you're exactly on target. Our guest has been Jeff Schaefer, senior counsel for the Alliance Defense Fund. The issue is the Supreme Court's two decisions on the Ten Commandments. I want to know what you think. Where would you stand on this question? Leave them in or take them out. The phone number 877-893-8255. 8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Why does it matter anyway? Give us a call. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
To the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmueller.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Well, the issue is the U.S. Supreme Court's two decisions today on the Ten Commandments, and a lot of folks are going to look at this. It's been interesting to see the mainstream media is basically saying it's a draw. Win here, lose there, no big deal. Well, let me tell you what the big deal is, because I think this particular set of decisions sets us up not only for endless litigation, but for a true constitutional disaster. And it's exactly what Mr. Schaefer was talking about as we ended the last segment. It comes down to this. If the very posting of the Ten Commandments represents an unconstitutional establishment of religion, precisely because there is religious content. That's the phrase. There is religious content in the Ten Commandments. Big surprise there, right? Because there is religious content in the Ten Commandments, we can no longer even acknowledge the Ten Commandments as fundamental to our system of law. Because that is to privilege one religion over another. Well, let's just talk about an historical fact. Western civilization did not come out of Buddhism, did not come out of Jainism or Taoism or Hinduism. Came out of Christianity. And the very framework of our civilization, including its understanding of law, comes out of a Christian framework in which the Ten Commandments were understood to be a law prior to the secular law. It was understood that the government's construction of law only had binding authority because God had already given a law, a moral law, through the Ten Commandments and these moral principles that God had revealed, even in creation, so that the law of man, the secular law, the government's law, made sense and was binding and authoritative. What we have now is this incredible experiment in secularizing the law such that the law simply is what it says it is on the authority of those who say it. Now, I'm one of those who thinks that such a law has no binding authority on the long run, and that's why you have judges and legislators just making it up as they go along. Now, Justice Antonin Scalia understands this, and if you really want to understand some very, very interesting literature, just look at his dissents in the major court cases in which he's been in the minority. Today is no different. Let me just read to you from the first paragraph of today's issued dissent. Justice Scalia wrote, "I shall discuss first why the court's oft-repeated assertion that the government cannot favor religious practice is false. Second, why today's opinion extends the scope of that falsehood even beyond prior cases. And third, why even on the basis of the court's false assumptions, the judgment here is wrong." Wrong, wrong, wrong. Strike three, you're out, says Justice Scalia. Further down in his dissent, he says this, "Nothing stands behind the court's assertion that the government's affirmation of the society's belief in God is unconstitutional except the court's own say-so, citing his support only the unsubstantiated say-so of earlier courts going back no further than the mid-20th century. And it is, moreover, a thoroughly discredited say-so." Justice Scalia says this is legal nonsense. This is just the court trying to legislate. It's trying to make a determination based not upon the Constitution, but upon what a majority of the justices in 2005 thinks will work. It is a pragmatic understanding of the law rather than a principled understanding of the law. Justice Scalia gets right to the heart of it. If this majority opinion, or we should say these majority opinions, really represents the trajectory of the court, we are in big trouble. Because it is asserting that the mere mentioning of God in a document such as this, posted in a public place on government grounds, is an imposition of religious belief and the privileging of one religion, in this case, the Judeo-Christian religion, over another. That heritage over all other heritages. Well, this is just an historical question. We can answer that very quickly. America was born out of a Christian civilization, a Christian worldview. That's not to say that all the founders were believing Christians. It is to say that it was the Christian understanding of law that was fundamental to the establishment of the entire nation. Is it now unconstitutional for the court to acknowledge that simple historical fact? I really want to know what you think about this. I know that a lot of you out there are really concerned about this, and especially those in Kentucky who will now have their courtroom stripped of the Ten Commandments display. along with other historical documents, I think there's going to be a lot of outrage. I want that outrage to get channeled in a healthy direction. Those of you in Texas and familiar with the Texas case, you may think this was a near miss because your monument can stay. The question is, for how long? How long will it be before Justice Stephen Breyer's point about the lack of controversy is nullified by those who will target that particular monument for renewed controversy? Give me a call. 877-893-8255 is the phone number. 877-893-TALK. The issue is the Ten Commandments, and here's another big question. Just how seriously should we as Christians fight for the right to post the Ten Commandments? I mean, after all, we know that that does not represent evangelism. That's no substitute for gospel proclamation and biblical preaching. See, here's my point. Putting them up is one thing. Arguing that they can't be there is quite another. A government that is scared of the Ten Commandments posted in a public place is a government that has lost its constitutional sanity and, quite frankly, is inviting its own disaster. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK, live from Louisville, Kentucky. We're talking about what's really important, and I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. This Ten Commandments set of decisions, I think we're going to be talking about it a long time. For one thing, it's going to be years before the lawyers get any kind of settlement on what this really means on a case-by-case basis. Look at all the courthouses, schoolhouses, public places in America, libraries and parks and all the rest. We're going to look at an avalanche of litigation, and that's just going to mean a lot of money for the lawyers. But in the meantime, I think it's a real threat to our understanding of what it means to be a people and what our constitutional liberties are. Let's go to Lonnie, calling from North Platte, Nebraska, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Lonnie, go right ahead.
Good afternoon, Al. I think that we missed a turn in that I believe the Supreme Court is just being consistent with a decision that they rendered, which basically eliminated the concept of local control of the public school system that came out of Massachusetts several years ago. I don't know the exact case, but their language was very telling in that they said that there was no longer a publicly held philosophy, morality, lifestyle that was legitimately being upheld by the existence of the school boards.
Yeah, I think the whole issue there, I think, Lonnie, you're drawing the issue of local control. And after all, that is an issue here because you had a county in the case of Kentucky that simply decided to do this. The county government approved it and all the rest. And you're really not talking about what the people of McCreary County, Kentucky want. You're talking about what special interest groups have now won in terms of a court decision. You know, you can try to tie all this together. And, of course, you can look at all these decisions, whether it's about school boards and local control or zoning and religious expression and all the rest. And you can make the argument either way that the government, in terms of the court, is now trying to have greater or lesser authority in these questions. You have the whole question of federalism. But it seems to me the big question right now is the religious expression question, because that's where these two decisions really focus. And it's on the fact that the Ten Commandments are a, and this is their word, religious display. That seems to be the ground of offense. Let's go to Mike calling from Haines City, Florida, listening on XM. Mike, go right ahead.
Well, sir, I believe that this decision must be fought tooth and nail, and not just with prayer, but I believe God wants his people to be politically active. That's why he's put us here.
All right, Mike, let me ask you, what would you do? What would you suggest that we do in response to this? Because there are a lot of people who are wondering, hey, the Supreme Court's taking this action. What can we do? We can't vote them in or vote them out, right?
Well, maybe we need to have a change of attitude there. Maybe we should be able to vote them in and out.
Well, let me tell you, I think if you pass that around as a referendum right now, Mike, you just might get a majority of Americans to go on that. But I got to tell you the truth. I don't think we're going to get that constitutional amendment anytime soon. But let me tell you, I appreciate your frustration on this. I think there are a lot of Americans who share it. The phone number is 877-893-TALK, 877-893-8255. There's still time for you to call. We're going to go to Kimberly, listening on WFIA in New Albany, Indiana. Go right ahead, Kimberly.
Hi. I personally am against the fact that they're going to take this out, but my biggest, I guess, source of frustration is if they're going to say it's based on a case-by-case scenario, based on, you know, the religious intent, how can they do that on a case-by-case scenario since the Ten Commandments say the same thing no matter where they're posted?
Yeah, Kimberly, you know, your problem, your liability is that you're thinking in terms of common sense, and the court would have you to get over that. You're going to have to give up a common sense test, and you're going to have to understand their logic is everything depends upon how the display is put together, where it is, who has to see it, whether or not you have to pass it to get in the courtroom. And in the Kentucky case, they actually took issue with words that were highlighted in the text of the documents. And so I guess you could say context is everything according to these decisions. And Justice Breyer said that context includes whether or not there was even controversy when it was put together. And Justice Souter in his decision said it has to do with the psychological motivations of those who put the display up. And if they were religiously motivated, then it is a religious display. Now, remember, Kimberly, this is the same court that's just playing around with whether or not you can even say in God we trust on the currency or say one nation under God in the pledge. And remember that in previous decisions, this court has said basically that it's okay so long as you're not referring to any God in particular. And so let's just be real honest here. The Ten Commandments aren't referring to any God in particular. And I think that's why there is a real offensiveness that is registered by those who have a secular agenda. This is a reference to the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the God who gave Moses the law. And I think that is the real ground of offense here. And yes, context is important. Where the display is, who has to see it. Even what words are highlighted. Great question, Kimberly. Great point. Let's go to Frank calling from Cleveland, Ohio, listening on WHKW. Frank, go right ahead.
Good afternoon, Dr. Mueller. The previous caller asked what we could do. Well, I think very specifically, if Judge Rehnquist retires, as there's been serious discussion, we need to see that Anton Scalia is nominated for Chief Justice. We need to contact our legislatures to make sure that he is approved and make sure that the right candidates are being selected to replace his seat on the bench.
You know, it is a fascinating vision, just to fantasize for a minute, about Chief Justice Antonin Scalia. I got to tell you, it just warms my heart to imagine someone with his legal philosophy as Chief Justice, not only because it would be great for him to give that leadership in the court in terms of its inner workings, but because I believe Chief Justice Scalia would speak so publicly to these issues. You know, Frank, I've got to be real careful. I'm not certain what will happen. Obviously, there's some big questions about likely resignations or retirements from the bench. And obviously, in the case of the Chief Justice, we're dealing with a very, very sick man. And so, you know, we'll simply have to watch this. But we do need to make certain that the Bush administration knows of our concerns about this. And I think given that administration's own dealings with the court, it's going to be inclined to send up a candidate that is going to really want to keep this court, return this court to constitutional sanity. And I think that's good news. Let's go to Tom, also calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Tom, go right ahead.
Hi, thank you. I think this really is not an issue when it comes to what is posted in a court. I think that our basic system of justice is what juries are instructed, that they are to base their decisions, A, on the evidence, and B, on the law that has instructed them from the court, from the judge, and they are specifically not to apply any external body of law or body of anything, whether it's the Bible or...
Okay, Tom, hold on just a minute. We're about to run out of time. Let me ask you, but what this decision really isn't just about a courthouse. You could say the same thing about a library. Does that change your opinion at all?
Oh, I think the court rulings might come down very differently if you post something in a library in a commemorative historical sense. I think decisions would allow for that. I think the problem is that they have posted a religiously oriented message in a place where it just doesn't belong.
All right. Well, listen, we're going right into a break. Tom, thanks for your call. You know, a place where it just doesn't belong. I guess that's exactly the claim being made by some. They appear to one of at least one of the decisions today. We'll be right back with some final reflections. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. You know, this issue of the Ten Commandments is going to be around for a long time. As a matter of fact, the two court decisions handed down today by the U.S. Supreme Court are going to make certain that's so, because they didn't settle anything. As a matter of fact, when the court came back and said that every single display of religious content on governmental property must undergo its own strict scrutiny. It basically invited a torrent of thousands and thousands of lawsuits that are going to be making their way through. I guarantee you, because the secular groups are going to be raising money on this. They're going to say, look, this is our chance to go ahead and organize and make our point, and let's just make sure that all the public space is free from all of these kinds of symbols and all the rest, whether it's a cross on a police emblem on a police car in California or the Los Angeles City Seal or whether it's a monument that was erected in a state park many years ago. You know, just take Justice Breyer's position that whether there was controversy when it was put in is determinative. I think there are people that will say, look, we can now bring controversy. And using Justice Breyer's point, we can claim that it now means even what it didn't mean before. And what about this psychological interpretation? You're going to go back and try to decide, look, the people who put this in really had a religious motivation. These people over here had a secular motivation. I think this is precisely the kind of jurisprudence, the kind of decision-making on the part of America's high court that leads us to be really concerned about what these people are thinking. Their role, according to the Constitution, is to make judgments based upon the actual text and content of the United States Constitution and to take into account what those who framed the Constitution meant in the first place. Folks, just think of the issues coming along. We've got the controversies over the Air Force Academy, and the real agenda many people think behind that is a move to eliminate the role of chaplains in the United States military service. We've got all kinds of other cases coming down. The Pledge of Allegiance case that was dodged by the court about a year ago, it's going to come back again, and the In God We Trust on the currency and all the rest. Now, as a Christian theologian, I want to tell you something, and I want to make this very, very clear. The kingdom of God does not stand or fall on decisions from the United States Supreme Court. Our right and our responsibility to preach and to teach the Bible as the Word of God and to share the gospel is not determined by a decision like this from the U.S. Supreme Court. What happened today really sets a cultural agenda. It establishes the kind of landscape we're going to have as a culture. It establishes the trajectory we're going to take as a society. And the trajectory that is set today means increasing secularity, an increasing amount of secular pressure against, well, all of us as citizens, to keep our religious convictions to ourselves. It's all right if you have the Ten Commandments in your church. It's all right if you post them in your home. It's all right if you carry them in your pocket. Just don't make us see it in public. That's their point. We as intelligent Christians have to take that into account and try to figure out how to respond in a way that is cogent and clear and understandable. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about the BTK killer, the nature of evil, and why we as Christians should be the ones who understand all this. I'll see you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Moeller's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.